glad I get the button.
Jesus.
Steve wasn't able to make it today, so you guys are stuck with me today. So we'll start with introductions. Terry Wall, Wall & Associates.
Greg Schaefer, Clark County Development Engineering.
Sharita Master, Public Works Development Engineering.
Jack Chumley, Building Department.
Bob Gaither, Gaither Homes.
Jeff Riston, Kingston Homes.
Andrew Doctor with PLS Engineering.
Mike Odwin Olson, Engineering.
Don Hardy with Mercury Dam.
James Housley is here. He's just on a call. He'll be right back in.
Back row.
Oh, yes.
EIA, Clark County.
Rod Swanson, Clark County Public Works, Clean Water. Steve Hanson, Auto Construction.
Houston Auto, Auto Construction.
Mitch Edwards, Clark County Community Development.
Brent Davis, Clark County Community Development.
Lori Lebowski, Clark County Community Planning.
Thanks for coming. Deeb meeting is being recorded. Audio will be posted on the Deeb's website. Has anyone had a chance to review the minutes?
I reviewed the minutes as they were emailed out, and I think, Mike, you had some edits.
We followed up. They made the edits, and I think Steve was able to review them, and he didn't have any other comments on the public comment portion of the minutes.
So we'll move that we accept them as written.
We'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Do we need to approve our agenda or just the minutes? what's next? Upcoming events.
As listed on the back page or page 2 of your agenda, Clark County Council work sessions and hearings are typical work sessions every Wednesday, beginning as early as 9 a.m. Check the grid for actual topics and schedules for that. There's often some modest adjustments. And also typically hearings every Tuesday, with the exception of the first Tuesday of the month, as 6 p.m. on Tuesday night. Specific work session, the 2019 through 2024 Transportation Improvement Program will be presented on July 18th, 11 a.m. And Planning Commission work sessions and hearings, we have the Yak Hall Mining, those at DNS, July 19th, 5:30 p.m. And also Rural Center staff report, those at DNS, and PowerPoint presentation, July 19th, 6:30.
Okay. Anything from you guys as far as
I should note that we did post, I worked with the council hearings office, and we did post, I don't remember the exact date, but it was towards the second half of June, but it did go out in June, our member replacement as requested by Mike Nieto.
Okay.
So, and we typically run that about 5 or 6 weeks to give a broad opportunity there for, the members to take a look at that and apply. So. That closes by the end of July, so I think by our next meeting, I'll be able to come back in and report more specifically how it's looking for candidates and interviews for that.
Okay. We'll go to Paradise Point Circulation Plan.
So, Terry?
Yeah.
We might also note that Mr. Green was able to join us.
SGA Engineering.
Thank you, Eric, for fitting us in.
That was really bad last week, so I stuck in this entire room.
So, Lori Lebowski, Clark County Community Planning. First item is a docket item called Paradise Point Circulation Plan. Actually, what it's about is the road around the ALNA Casino. Just to give you some background, as you all know, the casino opened last year. The county initially received complaints from the neighborhood that's located to the west of the casino about being not having the ability to get in and out of their neighborhood to I-5 past the casino. So in response to those complaints, the county council placed a docket item for this year to develop a circulation plan for that area. I'm going to be going to council for a work session August 1st. From my assessment, I don't believe now is the time to have a circulation plan for that area, and I'm going to give you some reasons why. The first reason being that there was a second, as you all may or may not know, there's a second lane constructed in front of the casino in March, and we've noticed since that second lane was constructed that we're receiving fewer complaints in that area. So the ultimate design for that road is to be a four-lane minor arterial. Typically, four-lane minor arterial, the design volume is to carry about 24,000 vehicles a day. And each lane accommodating about 6,000 vehicles per day. So I went out there and took some pictures of the new lane. The top photo is obviously facing the casino, and the van there is using that second lane. So it's an auxiliary lane. It's for the cars that are heading from I-5 to the casino. They can take a right there. And then you have another lane to the left of that for the through traffic to go to the neighborhood. And then the bottom picture is facing east, again, across from the casino. I'm just showing that if you see that the pickup truck, it's heading west of the casino, it's going through. So, did a count of lots in that area, the neighborhood west of the casino. It's about 100 lots. So, rule of thumb, it's about 1,000 trips per day. So, basically, what I'm saying is that we should wait and see on whether or not we add a road or have a road to go around the casino to serve that neighborhood. I think, in my assessment, the bottom line is that there's not enough residential houses out there to really justify putting in another road. As you all may or may not know, there's some environmental issues out there. You're in a rural area. The only way a road would be constructed out there would be through a county road project. Not likely to happen, given the priority roads. So this is what I'm presenting to the council on August 1st. So that's a summary of what I was just saying. Are there any questions? Yes, Bob?
Well done. Thank you for the presentation.
Yeah.
What do you want from us today is the first question.
I would like your support to say this is a good idea. Let's wait and see if we have this additional road. And that I would like an email or a letter of support from your membership from Deep saying we agree with this assessment and that we really should wait and see.
Second comment or question.
Sure.
You may note, or you may not, feel that it's beneficial to know what the traffic analysis said or recommended in your comments. That may add ammunition for you.
Okay.
Thirdly, is it really 6,000 vehicles a day that's the problem, or is it the 4 to 6 window, you know, the commute window?
Peak hour traffic.
Really, the issue's been when they have events.
Oh, event, yeah, okay.
It's the events, it's not peak hour. When I first put this PowerPoint together, the casino was not going to have events on weekends, but they've changed that now. But okay. Generally, they have events on Thursday nights, and I believe now they have them on Saturdays.
What do they do at the fairgrounds? Because I know that's kind of a similar area. So did they build some special road there?
There are some roads there, and they have C-Tran has buses that go out there. They have a neighborhood traffic plan for that area. But also, the fair is what, 2 days?
No, when they have events up there, it's kind of similar actually, like concerts.
Right.
When it packs up, and I know it was a big issue when it first opened, but maybe it's not as much anymore for the residents.
I believe they also built some roads out there.
Lori?
But just real quick, that's the fairgrounds, it's a county property, and so I can see where you would build some roads for that.
Maybe I missed when you were talking about this as I was looking at the map and just looking at the roads, but was there a traffic study done? I didn't see any.
There was one for when the casino first opened.
And what did it say with regards to the need for additional vehicular circulation around the area?
It didn't say anything about it.
So it stayed silent on it?
Yes.
So this was maybe a, for lack of a better term, a knee-jerk reaction to the complaints of some of the residents as a result of some highly attended events that has now, I think, been taken care of with the opening of the other lanes.
Right.
Yeah, and I just wanted to support what Bob was saying, which I think, you know, if it's a level of service issue in terms of delay, that would be helpful, I think, in your argumentation. I mean, was it a perceptual issue that it's just more congested but still within level of service? That would be really helpful, I think.
Okay.
You know, is it something that people like, yeah, I never had to wait at all to ride the freeway and now I have to wait? Or are they waiting 5 minutes to get to the freeway? Those are different scenarios.
I think initially when the casino opened, before they had the additional lane, they were waiting. There were a couple times where there were some issues, but since that additional lane's open, we've not heard any complaints. But I appreciate the feedback and I'll have the information.
So just a suggestion on the PowerPoint, because I know Mike just said he was looking at the map. And it probably would be nice to kind of see a big aerial, you know, view of the area to show where it's at.
Okay.
So they understand the issue a little bit more.
Okay.
So.
And kind of piggybacking on what Don said with regards to level of service, is there a requirement for monitoring of traffic patterns and capacity out there as there is for, similar to what the amphitheater has to do?
No. And the reason is that this is a reservation. And in fact, I did not know this, but the reservation, if they wanted to, they could expand.
Mm-hmm.
And that road that is adjacent to the casino that used to be a county road and that now belongs to the Cowlitz tribe, and been renamed Cowlitz Way. So it's a different type of situation. The only area that the county monitors are the roads that are outside of the reservation. But and those are rural roads, they're outside of the road boundary, and the concurrency doesn't apply.
And don't typically circulation plans, aren't those usually reserved for urban areas anyway?
Yes.
But to your point, though, there was an interchange justification process that they had to go through for WDOT, mm-hmm. Mike and I think. So there, it wasn't like there was not a review process.
Oh, no, I understand that, yeah.
Has anyone been out there during a concert recently? Probably, the answer is probably no, but it'd be interesting. I mean, the council may, we still don't know that there isn't a problem out there. It sounds like it's a hard solution to even figure out what they'll do if there is a problem out there. But it'd be interesting to know during a significant event what it was like anyway. I mean, I don't know.
I've never been there.
I haven't been there either. So.
There's a staff person gave me the name of a neighbor out there who's called before, and I tried to get a hold of him, and he's not called me back.
Yeah, it'd just be interesting to know whether the problem really, truly has gotten better, you know, or rather than the metric of we have less complaints. Well, that's a good metric, that's for sure.
That's why we're here.
It's telling, but, you know, maybe it's also summer, too, so
right.
Maybe the next.
So you're looking for like a vote, basically a vote from us in support of what you're presenting in your position?
Yes.
Does anyone want to do that? Put that forward?
Well, the conclusions make sense, Lori. I'm just trying to process here. How would DEEB, what level of support could we offer or suggest for you as you head to the Planning Commission? Did I hear you say that? County Council?
Well, we don't have any.
As you?
We don't have a PC. This isn't, This isn't scheduled for the hearing process right now. It is on the docket. What we're proposing to do is take it off the docket list for this year and then possibly revisit it if there are issues.
I'm just trying to figure how would we word a motion, let's say, in support of what you're asking.
In support of not doing something.
Yeah, because we don't have we don't have a whole lot of first-hand observation or...
I mean, yeah, it might be something like, you know, based on the information presented to us, it makes sense to continue to monitor the situation and see if it has been resolved by the additional lien. I mean, something like that. I mean, because I don't think we have enough information to say
that's
more than that.
My concern,
if you don't have enough information,
yeah. But I mean, I think I have enough information to say continue to monitor it and see if it's resolved by the additional lien. It's kind of it kind of pushes it down the road, but that's kind of what you're recommending, so.
Right.
So was that a motion you just made?
Sure.
I like that. I second. I think that makes sense.
I would agree. I think that's everybody's on the same page.
That's why we're here. Right?
Are you okay on
that's why it was uncomfortable.
Sheree. Give that one more run. So.
Okay, based on the information presented to us, we recommend continuing to monitor the situation and see if the second westbound through lane solved the issue.
Second.
Discussion?
All in favor?
Hold on. I'd like to amend that, only to say, however, we would agree that at this point in time that a circulation plan is not necessary.
Well, yeah, I think it's implied that we continue to monitor because I personally don't think we have enough information to say that it's not warranted right now.
I'll withdraw my amendment. Okay.
Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
That's a good point.
So, Lori, very quickly, council has asked us to recap any motions that Deep has done, and so I will capture that. And before I go to the council, I'll send a draft back out to Deep so everybody can look at it. And so when I send it to council, I'll copy you.
I'm going to move on to my next presentation. This is the manufactured housing code update. Does everybody have copies of the code changes? Okay. I'm not going to go through every single chapter. I'm going to point out some key chapters. Most of the code sections are deleting references or that sort of thing. So, last year...
Just a moment before you start, Lori. I'm sorry to interrupt. Is what is in our packet the same thing that was emailed out to us?
Yes.
Okay. Because sometimes that's not the case. That's why I asked.
No, it's a good question. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so last year, mainly Councilor Blanc initiated a project to what he termed innovative housing. There were three parts to it. First part was adopting code for cottage housing so that people had that option if they wanted to build that type of development that would be available. And then a second part of it was the accessory dwelling unit code, I don't know if you all recall or not, last year. So then part three was updating the manufactured housing code. And as you can see, that there's a lot of extensive changes that need to be done, chapters to go through and references and whatnot. So we all decided last year we'll kick the can down the road to this year. And so here we are, and it's on the docket list for this year. So basically what I did was I revised the code to comply with the state legislation about manufactured housing. So the state, and I'm sure this is super easy to see. So the bottom line is this. The county cannot regulate manufactured housing any different way than other types of housing. If we wanted, for example, if we wanted to regulate the pitch on roofs, that's fine. We just have to do that for all houses. And the other part is that we can't restrict the location of manufactured housing. And then another part is that we can't adopt an ordinance that prevents, what happened? We can't adopt an ordinance that prevents requiring removal of recreational vehicles from a manufactured home park. So given the direction from the state, I went into our Title 40 code and made some recommended changes. So what's changing? I'm going to walk you through the code sections, and as I mentioned, there are just a few of them. So let's see. The first one is code section 40.100, the definitions, page 7. So kind of toward the bottom of the page, there's a definition of single-family dwelling. I'm making a recommendation that we expand the definition of single-family dwelling to include manufactured homes and modular homes. And in a second, I'll get into more about what we mean by manufactured homes and modular homes.
So that's the language that is mandated by the federal government? Where do you get that language?
I got the language from the legislation, and I'll get to that.
Okay, great.
That's a great question, and that's the next thing I'm going to discuss. But I thought the easiest thing for us to do is to just expand the definition of single family dwelling to include manufactured home and modular home. And to answer Ott's question, go to page 15 and 16. Those are the definitions. So you'll see on page 15, we're deleting the current definition. Currently, we combine the definition of manufactured home with mobile home. That's going to go away. And then if you go to page 16, we're adding definitions. And those definitions I got from the federal law, and also which is implemented through the state law. That slide where I had the RCW up, that's basically where I got the definition. Yes.
So two mobile homes really are a manufactured home, or manufactured homes are really a manufactured home park?
Yes.
And under the, there's a lot of parks around here.
That's on one tax parcel.
What's that?
That's on one tax parcel, if you have two on one tax parcel.
Yes.
So one, you couldn't have one as an ADU, because it'd have to be attached. So.
Well, we are changing the definition of single family law. So it could be an ADU, depending on the square footage and the regulations of accessory dwelling. So
my question with regards to the definitions in here
change that to manufactured home
is
the same
almost the complete removal of the mobile home definition. So is a mobile home a single family dwelling?
It is, but what we're proposing to do is allow mobile homes to stay. So the definition we have of mobile home is something that's a mobile home that was manufactured before 1976.
Okay, so.
So what we're proposing to do is that placing a new, if you want to place a mobile home as defined here, so as defined here, that would be, for example, something that was manufactured in 1975.
Right.
If you really want to do that, you have to get a red tag from HUD. Which apparently you can. There's a process and a cost to it.
So my question or my concern here is that there might be people, when we talk about affordable housing, there might be people out there, and there might still be mobile homes that are available for sale, as well as still being lived in.
Sure.
And you're including modular manufactured homes in your single-family dwelling definition, but not mobile homes. So it kind of leaves it out there in limbo. And so, and at the same time, we talk about a manufactured home park, but you don't include mobile homes in that manufactured home park.
Right.
Are mobile homes allowed in a manufactured home park?
Yes, but just to answer your question, I just expand on it.
Okay.
We're talking about new development.
Okay.
This is new development.
That's not clear, because what I'm now concerned with is creating a non-conforming situation based on just the definitions here, right out of the gate.
So
there's a section on that later.
Is there?
There is, yeah. There's a section on that, I know. But it is a little confusing that you cannot create a new mobile home park.
You can.
Well, it'd be a manufactured home park.
Right.
So in the manufactured home park, you could not place a unit built before 1976. Is that correct? If you're doing a new mobile manufactured home park, then you couldn't place one of the older ones there.
That's kind of my question.
Yeah.
So
that's
the answer would be no if you can't get a tag for it. If you can't get a HUD tag for it, the answer is no. If you can, if you really want to, then yes.
And so
is that explained in here?
Yes.
Okay, so then do we still need a mobile home park definition and then say that it requires some tag from HUD? Because then we actually have mobile home park still. There's still a definition that needs to still be in here, maybe?
That was listed somewhere else, I thought.
Or no?
That wasn't in it?
I can add language for existing, but I believe in that code language, I think it says something about prior to 2008 that it would remain. Because basically, this is just for new development. This is for a new manufactured home park. It's replacing new manufactured homes.
Lori, what's significant with the date of June 15th, 1976, that makes a mobile home all of a sudden a manufactured home?
We got that from the HUD standards.
Right.
And that's also in the state law.
I think what we're trying to establish here is that with these changes in the definitions as well as regulations, that we don't discount the ability for someone to be able to place a mobile home in a manufactured home park.
Right.
Even based on the definitions, I'm seeing that, you know, we talk about manufactured home park of two or more, and mobile is stricken, and it just says manufactured homes.
Right, that's the existing definition for mobile home park. The only thing I'm changing is just striking out mobile and putting in manufactured.
Right, so if I have a really nice mobile home and I want to put it in a mobile home park, if I'm reading this definition, by the mere fact it says manufactured home park, which is now what it would be called.
Right.
Mike, can I ask you a question? You used the word mobile home.
Yes.
So, and I could be way off on this, but a mobile home is simply a manufactured home that was built before June 15th, 1976. Is that
right.
True?
Right. Now, are we using these definitions interchangeably?
That's what I was just
saying. No.
I don't know. Like, manufactured home doesn't really have a definition. It used to. Kind of.
Well, there is.
Yeah.
It's at the top of
the next page.
Top of page 16.
Yeah, it's a manufactured home constructed after June 15, 1976, in accordance with state and federal requirements for manufactured homes. What is a manufactured? I mean, I see a mobile home is one that consists and is transportable in sections, and then there's a definition of the modular.
Right.
Being built in a factory.
It just says in accordance with state and federal requirements for manufactured homes. That's the definition.
But is there no I guess what I'm saying are these all interchangeable? I mean, they used to be, right?
No, they're not.
Because it says under WAC.
I could offer a bit of clarification from just a building permitting perspective. The mobile homes are typically built to be moved, and they maintain wheel assemblies and the chassis in the mobile home parks. In RCW 5920, the specific Landlord-Tenant Act for mobile home parks and tenancies. We're in a manufactured home park. There is no implication that the wheel assembly or the moving assembly will be left in place. That's to be removed and placed on
the
truck.
That's the difference. So that's the,
okay.
Is that common knowledge for what?
I don't think that's what this says, though.
No,
that's what I'm guessing. Industry knowledge.
Yeah.
Or industry knowledge, I guess, but if it's...
Also, we're changing, the first section is Title 14, which is the building code.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So on these definitions,
yes.
If you have... basically what Mitch was just talking about, but it was just manufactured last year. Okay, because you can still go buy one. I can go buy a park model or something like that, and they sell what I would consider a mobile home. But the definition of mobile home here, it has to be built before 76. So without that definition, you actually have a real, something I would consider a mobile home by industry standards, but we would then classify it as a manufactured home because it was built after 76.
Well,
which doesn't make sense to me. I think there's like three different things here.
There's three different things. They're all separate, and that's to update the code to comply with state and federal law. What you're talking about, a park model, would be a recreational vehicle.
Well, and not even a park model, but just a single wide then. You can still buy a single wide that was just recently manufactured that still has the axis and the chassis and everything on it.
Right.
So under these new definitions, we would, I guess, put it in a manufactured home, which when I consider a manufactured home, I'm thinking more what Mitch was saying, that it's kind of like modularized, but it doesn't have like axles. They're not even like in a straight line like a mobile. They can be all kinds of shapes. They were just built in boxes, delivered on site, and put on an actual core foundation. That, I think, I'm not sure what the law says, but is it just applied to manufactured, or does it also apply to mobile homes?
That would be a manufactured home.
Okay. But I also could need three definitions then. And just to make it clear, because I think you have a modern manufacturer, modern mobile home built after 76. Then you have a manufactured home, which doesn't have an axle or a frame or any of those things that you would consider a mobile home. And then you have the older style mobile home before 76. Does that make sense?
And then you have modular.
Yeah, modular.
Well, that would be manufactured. Modular would be manufactured then.
Modular is usually pieced together.
Right.
So, but that would be a type of manufactured, right?
Sarkmila back in the 80s built hard, I don't know how long your devices were built, but Sarkmila used to manufacture modular homes. So, you used to put some walls together in its factory, the crane hoist everything together, and still got inspection. And you can still, you can order modular homes and piece them together, and they can be all kinds.
Sure.
The park model that you're referencing, a single wide, for the most part is a manufactured home because when they go to the park, they pull off chassis and axle. And when we develop land all the time, when they have, it's on there, they're manufactured for the most part, and like a chassis in the woods.
Yeah. So then the new ones truly are
some people
manufactured homes then?
They block or some people skirt around it and just not block.
So
there's limited provisions for any type of mobile home.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the trailer would be an RV, which is a recreational vehicle, and it's got a separate definition.
I guess the main thing that I'm trying to get to is that If somebody has a mobile home built before 76, this date in here, that they still have a place that they're able to put it?
I would say yes.
Okay.
They can get a tag.
Okay. If they can get a tag. Understood. Yes.
And that's
understood.
The controlling factor is the HUD red tag.
Okay.
I think that's my issue as well. I get the affordability issue on the individual new lot. But there are mobile home parks that are pretty on the fringe on Highway 99, and many of them. And that would be the worst unintended consequence. And now these people are actually homeless because of the change here versus being able to stay where they're at or not.
They could stay where they're at.
Yeah.
They could stay where they're at. Actually, this would make it better because if they want to place a park model in that mobile home park, as long as they can get the L&I permit, then they can do it.
Okay.
Before I move on, I want to make sure that I heard what your recommendation is. So, the mobile home, did you want some language about this applies
Well, I was just trying to figure it out myself because I kind of thought that there's two different things from what Mitch was saying. You know, a mobile home usually is with the axle and all that, and then a manufactured is more of what I would call like a modular or something that was built in a factory and then is delivered, but not necessarily with the axles and meant to be able to be moved easily.
Okay.
Once it's in. Once it's in, for a manufactured, I think once it's in, it's kind of in. It's not like you move it very easily, right? Where a mobile home, you could put those axles back on, you could move it again. That's, and I think there still are things built today that most people in the industry would say is a mobile home. So we don't have a category for that. We just lump them into manufactured then.
No, that would be a recreational vehicle.
Yeah. You really need to read the RCW in conjunction with this curve. You can't read them separately.
Okay.
Everything you're talking about is dealt with right in the RCW.
Okay. So then if we're in conformance with that, then it works.
Yeah,
so.
All I did was get the definitions from the RCW.
Okay.
And that's, if you have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation, that's...
That was a lot. 2 months ago? 3 months ago? 3 months ago?
No, this is a newer one. I just had it in the presentation.
Let's do this. In June, we
did it.
So, slide number 3. That is tiny, tiny writing. The RCW 3601225.
Yeah, what are you referencing on that?
So basically, it's saying a county may not adopt an ordinance that has the effect directly or indirectly discriminating against consumer choices in the at home they want.
Yeah, okay.
And then it has another reference that you have to go to get
it. If there's a protection there, I'm good with it.
So, Lori, on that same section, RCW 36, number D. One of the requirements is the home is thermally equivalent to the state energy code.
Right.
That's how you get the certification.
Who makes that determination?
That's the HUD. It depends on what we're talking about. So a modular home, you would get a permit from Labor and Industries.
And I mean, I'm not trying to nitpick here because I'm all for it. It's just... Yeah, hey, I bought my mobile home or my manufactured home, and I want to put it on the home place. Fine, demonstrate that it is thermally equivalent to the state energy code.
Right, and typically that's the HUD red tag that you have.
And the county would accept that.
Yes. If you wanted to place what's commonly known as a park model or a recreational vehicle in a manufactured home park, you can do that, but then you have to get a permit from Labor and Industries.
Okay.
And I believe that's the yellow tag.
Yep.
Do you mind if I move on?
Yep. I think you beat that one.
Thank you.
It's not moving. It's on. So we're going to repeal section 4260.130. And the reason we're doing that is that talking about the RCW, about how you place manufactured homes. There's some regulations on it about how you place manufactured homes outside of a manufactured home park. So we're eliminating that section of code. So what we have been doing is that when we have a lot of plats that have notes on them that say no manufactured homes, after this, if this code is adopted, if the county council adopts the code, and the ordinance, if they decide to do that, any plats that are made after that time, they can no longer have that plat note on it. You could still have it in your CCNRs. You could still do that. The question that our county attorneys are looking at are the older plats and what happens in that situation. And I'm still waiting to get an opinion from our county attorney. But we have a lot of plat notes that have old ones that say all kinds of things that we no longer honor because of changes in state and federal law. And then, as I mentioned, So we're expanding the definition of single-family dwelling. I've included the different definitions of manufactured home and modular home. So I'm going to jump to 42. Yes.
Before you leave this slide?
Yeah, no.
Oh, got it. Good.
Okay.
Sorry. I thought you were leaving that slide.
I'm keeping the code section that I've been talking about, and I'm going to go to 4260140 on page 1. So that's 4260140, page 1, lines 5 through 8 at the top there. As long as they can get the L&I check. And that's to comply with the RCW 3601-225.3. Does everyone, are you all at that section?
Right. You found it 4261?
4261.
Yeah, 4260-140, page 1. Lines 5 through 8. And actually, we had an open house in June, and we had I sent out notice to the manufacturing park owners, and this was something, a change that they wanted. They wanted to have that ability if somebody has a park model. You have people that are snowbirds.
I don't think some of us have it.
Yeah. Which pages I have?
What's that?
I'm with you.
I have it. I brought mine.
He brought it.
I've got it.
Last 7 years.
What?
I paid for my own printer. Sorry. I am cheap.
You can print on double sided.
So, Lori, what's the relevant point?
What's that?
What's the relevant point that you're making?
So, okay, 4260-140. The relevant point that I'm making is that I'm proposing a change to allow placement of a recreational vehicle in a manufactured home park, as long as they get the labor and industry permit.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't have any issue with that.
And as I said, we had an open house, and that was the feedback we got from a lot of manufactured home park owners, is they want to have that ability for people who live there, that if they want to place a park model in a manufactured home park, that they have that ability to do that.
So, this is a policy question. But is that good policy to have affordable housing spaces taken up by snowbirds?
You also people—they're not all snowbirds. I'm just using that as an example. This is only in a manufactured home park.
And would this be a certain?
But then it becomes an RV park all of a sudden.
Back to James.
We've been down that.
Is that like a year-long?
I don't want to go down that.
Year-long residency, or is that like any time you're there, or you need to be?
I think what's governing it is the permit. If you can get a permit for that type of home, then you can place it. I don't have any kind of time limit on it. And it's only, and we're only talking about manufactured home parks.
So again, I go back to my hope. It's a policy question. Are we incentivizing snowbirds or park owners to favor them and they pay more rent for that space, which is somebody that may be, you know, truly on the cusp of affordability?
I use that as an example,
yeah.
Just an anecdote from.
I think what would be more, what would happen more often, Jamie, is that you would have people that can't afford anything but a park model.
Okay.
A park model, I think, is different than an RV.
Yeah.
A park model is like a.
Not under the statute, by definition, it's a recreational vehicle.
Really? Okay. Statute.
I think what we're talking about, park model, is a single ride.
Single ride.
But I do have a question on this. Is there a loophole that somebody could exploit if you're allowing a manufactured home park to have RVs for a developer to put in a manufactured home park rather than an RV park?
Well, I think the bottom line is they have to get the L&I permit, so, and that's and that complies with the state law that they meet energy standards and structural standards.
Correct, but from the county standpoint, you're talking about allowing another use in a different zone. So is there a different standard for the manufactured home park than there is an RV park? If you're allowing an RV in a manufactured.
The RV park wouldn't, none of the units would have to meet this LMIC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does create a loophole.
Yeah, was there?
And I don't know what the consequences if there are.
Well, it's definitely a difference in housing type. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and probably density too.
Density.
You can't
open space,
density.
Or if there's an open space requirement or whatever it be.
We went over the RV parks. There was a limited time frame that you could be there parked. It was like, I want to say, was it 90 days?
Yeah.
So we had 90-day limitation on how long an RV could be placed, which is what would circumvent someone shortcutting or loopholing the system.
So now you have a manufactured park where they don't have a time limit on their RV.
Yeah, so then the RV could be there longer.
That's a clear loophole.
But you have to hit the LNI permit. You have to meet the structural standards. You have to meet the energy standards. Sure.
There is a provision in Washington State RCW that provides for RVs occupied primary residences are permitted in manufactured home parks.
Mm-hmm.
Those are permitted. And that came out of case law that was established back in the 2000s when a couple of jurisdictions tried to prevent or use of RVs as primary residences and RV parks.
Right. And so this is complying with the state law.
Done.
Okay. Just a quick question, Lori. The allowance is not mandatory, right? Property owner chooses whether they allow that type of unit on their property or not. They're not required to allow an RV onto their site, is that?
I believe that they can't, I don't believe they can.
Based on what you just said, it sounds like you can't restrict
it. I believe it's optional. It's up to the park themselves. And the reason that came up is because in the older mobile home parks, the spaces were set up for single ones. And so they could not be reconfigured to accommodate for the manufactured homes that were coming out in a 30-by-40 dimension. And so they tried to find a way to without gentrifying the neighborhoods, try and find a way to accommodate and use that space for rental to people in RVs that were smaller than the actual single wides that they had in those places.
Are there any more questions? Okay. Final change is 4262.10. It's the temporary health hardship. So that's 4260210, that's the temporary health hardship. And basically, all I'm doing is allowing a modular home to be used as a temporary health hardship as long as it's not on a permanent foundation.
What are the restrictions to that?
What's that?
Well, I got a 6,000 square foot lot. I can pull in my RV and call it a temporary health hardship?
No.
Okay.
No. There's a whole process you got to go through.
Yeah. There's a whole process.
What are the unique restrictions that apply to that?
For a temporary health hardship, you have to get a doctor's note. So maybe your mom, maybe you want to watch your mother. She has health issues. You would have to get a doctor's note for her, and it has to be renewed, I believe, every
year. Yearly, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, I get that.
Right.
So now I have the right to set a modular home, a temporary modular home because of a health hardship on a lot. Mm-hmm. So what are the restrictions that apply to that, to siting and locating that modular home that's permitted under a temporary health hardship?
So you have to have a doctor's note. Typically it has to be within a certain distance of the existing.
What are the zoning limitations? What are the setback requirements? What's the density requirement? Are they unique to temporary health hardship homes? Are they common to any accessory dwelling unit?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but a temporary health hardship typically has to be a manufactured home, and all this is doing is allowing a modular home to also be used as a temporary health hardship.
That's the only change.
That's the only change.
That's the only change.
That's a whole other.
We're not changing. They're not changing any of the part of the code except for allowing manufactured modular homes to be used in a temporary hardship.
It's not even that.
There's nothing unique about this, then. If, forgive me here if I'm interpreting this incorrectly, the state has already said you can't discriminate.
No.
There's really no distinction between a modular home put to any use, whether it be permanent or temporary, than any other type of structure. So there's nothing unique about that bullet point.
I'm just updating
just
the definition.
Yeah. Just clean up.
All right,
so that we're
thank
in.
You. Yeah,
just updating the terminology.
Thank you.
There's no change in setbacks or.
Right. I get it. Thank you. Yeah, good job.
Now, one last question from me that I want to make sure of is that, so my question is, can a mobile home built before 1976 still be used as a temporary health hardship?
If you get the permit.
Okay. Okay. It doesn't say that, but I'm assuming that everybody agrees that it does say that and that somewhere that's clear.
It references the federal code already.
Yeah.
Goes back. Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
All right. So this is... So this is the timeline for adoption. So council work session August 8th, and then the planning commission work session August 12th, the hearing August 16th, and then another council work session in September, and then the hearing is September 18th. That's all I have as far as the presentation. There is a website. I'm just going to pull up the website really quick so you know where it is.
Lori, you're looking for a motion from us to support the changes proposed today. What are you looking for?
Yes.
Yes.
So moved.
Second.
Discussion?
Yes, I have one more question.
Okay.
Sorry, I know you're going for it. So. It'll be quick. Under 4032A, we talk about additions, alterations, and modifications. You have added alterations into subset 1. Is there a definition for alteration? I did not see one.
No, I'm not sure where you're at in this.
Sorry. It came out with the information. It may not be in the packet that's today's, but it came in with what was emailed out to us earlier.
Okay.
Manufactured home placements and standards, Title 14.32A.
Okay. Yes.
Last page, it says, it talks about additions or alterations shall comply with all permit requirements. There's no definition of alteration, so I don't know what exactly that means and whether that's it. Something needs to be defined. More of a question.
Okay. I would go back to the definitions chapter, but
I did.
Go back and look at that.
Okay, if you would please, because I checked the definitions chapters and there wasn't anything in there about alteration.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll go back and I'll look at 14.
13. Oh, I just found it.
Structural alteration.
That's structural alteration. So if you could just look at that, that'd be appreciated.
Okay.
Now I'll be done.
Okay.
Maybe. Terry.
Sorry.
We have a motion in a second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay.
So can we recap on the language on the motion again?
The motion was to support the changes as proposed relating to the manufactured home code.
Okay.
Do we need to specifically cite out all the different code numbers?
I wasn't sure if I needed to add anything that Mike had just...
It was more for clarification.
Okay.
It was more for clarification. I think that if staff knows that there's no specific definition of alteration for manufacturer modular homes that they might want to look into putting one in there, if that's necessary.
Thank you, Lori.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks, Lori.
She couldn't get out of here.
Me too.
You
said 42 essentially. Again.
City Gate implementation updates.
Yes, thank you. Each of you has been, I'm Mitch Nicholson's, the Community Development Director, and I'd like to. I provided you a brief summary of the work that the functional oversight team has done in implementing CityGate strategic recommendations. I want to save as much time as I can for Brent's presentation because that's directly related to some of the process improvement that work is going to lead us to. For the functional oversight team, what we're doing, I'd like to explain a bit about what we're doing there. And this is, we're reverse engineering residential tax lot permit, which is one of our more complex and more involved permits that engages a large portion of our development review partners, internal partners. And this is being done, reverse engineering helps us start with a known, a fact. And what we know is that the permit was issued. And then we find out what led to that permit issuance and all the touch points and interactions that staff had along the way to get to that point. We're using a real-life permit to do that and found ourselves looking at a permit that somewhere in the neighborhood of 13 to 14 months in the review process. So it was a very substantial amount of review, counter-review, additional review, competing reviews, touch points, and so forth, where there was waiting for response, trying to clarify and give our applicant information that would help them succeed with the review process. At the end of the day, what we're doing with reverse engineering is looking at structurally being able to take a long, extended process like that and all the touch points and start moving pieces out of that and rearranging it so it compresses that time frame to where with a robust and complete application that really does a good job of informing the staff that are involved in the review process, being able to compress that time frame to something much more reasonable and in the around a 30-day or less time frame. Doing that gives us an opportunity to really explore and ask ourselves, why do we do what we do? Why is this review necessary? And why is this review necessary at this point? And then align that with our staff and resources and reviewers to ensure that we have the right person doing the right review at the right time at the earliest opportunity. So if we have a robust intake process that really does have somebody with some extensive institutional knowledge about our permitting process, they can do a good job of asking appropriate questions to inform that intake to ensure the right documentation is there, to ensure we're not reviewing and rejecting a review because there's a single page of missing information or design. Getting that dialed in and giving ourselves and our applicants the earliest opportunity for success with our application process, with our information sharing process, and with the quality of our information being elevated to the nth degree. So anybody sitting in their home on their computer can go to a resource for that permit application and get exactly the information they need to succeed with our process. And if they don't, there's help buttons there to help them navigate that system. And that's really what we're shooting for. I know this is, it's a lot to do, but it is doable. I've worked in that environment before for 16 years in Pasco. I've worked with AHO, I've worked with New Traditions, worked with Rachi. I mean, there's a whole bunch of folks, Olin Homes. They all enjoyed that robust process, but it was set up in that way. And this is just finding a way to identify the nuances here that are specific to Clark County that absolutely have to be engaged, but eliminating those things that don't or compressing and combining things and processes that really get us to an elevated level of success very early in the application process. So I'll be happy to take any questions. Yes?
Just to be clear that I heard this correctly, the example you cited was a an approval that took 12 to 13 months, did you say?
Total time, yes.
And your goal is to get that down to a standard 30-day?
Or less.
That's for tax lot, one single-family residence.
That's correct. But
well, that's remarkable.
There's a lot behind that.
That's remarkable.
There's a lot behind
it's,
that.
It's also doable. And we brought a lot of partners to the table, both internal and external. We have a lot of stakeholders there, just to give us the guidance we need in knowing what are the challenges they face with us and with their own processes. Can they go back and have a meaningful conversation with their designers to actually engage our process properly? Are they getting information to them that's critical? So when they get something as simple as the foundation soils report, they actually have an example of what that looks like in the application packet. Instead of having to decipher 40 pages of the stormwater code to get to the same conclusion.
So Mitch, of course, I think we're all in support of that, but I just want to be sure that I understand what you're intending. The functional oversight team included private industry experts.
Yes.
Did you were you able at are you also including county staff?
Yes.
And they're on board with, yeah, we can take what we did in 12 months and get it down to 30 days.
They are on board with the concept. We don't know that we can get there yet until we do the work, until we actually re-engineer the process.
Mm-hmm. Great.
But so what we have is a huge amount of support and a huge amount of people looking at their own processes saying, I think we can do this. And what Brent's going to propose here in a second is a perfect illustration of some process improvements that really get to that.
How much of that 12-month process was the applicant's fault?
Well, so a lot of it. The challenge there is, what was the quality of information the applicant had to get to success, to get to the point that they could return that comment or return that revision at a higher rate of speed? What were they dealing with? What did we give them in the way of our comment and response that gave them the tool they needed to get it right absolutely quickly?
Was this a situation where they should have known, or their consultants should have known, or is it a situation where the way things are right now,
go ahead, Jamie.
I was just going to say, I'm going to try to bring me positive about this. I don't think we should be looking for blame, either, you know, pointing the finger at the county or pointing it at ourselves. I think it's part of this reverse engineering. We're trying to understand what the issues are to come up with solutions to make it better. And there's going to be a big onus, I think, on our industry as consultants and others to do things in a different manner, kind of front load information. So we are helping them out in their process to expedite it through. And, you know, I'm taking the view that Ryan and I were just in a meeting for an hour before this, that will probably affect, you know, maybe 80% of the applications coming through. There's going to be 20% that are the mom and pop that, you know, we will probably not address, and they're still going to be stuck in that, you know, longer process. But if we can unclog the majority of them with better material coming in, quicker output coming out, it'll be a lot better.
And I don't mean, I didn't want that to sound like I was laying blame anywhere. What I wanted to fully understand was the fact that it took 12 to 18 months or whatever, however long it took, purely as a result of the processes and the codes and the regulations that are currently in place here at the county? Or was it a matter of the people that were interpreting it couldn't interpret it, the people that were interpreting it didn't want to interpret it? So there's a whole range there.
I think I'd love to get to your question. I think the best way to capture this is, we're looking at opportunities to find out what we could have known,
okay,
and what we could have communicated.
Okay.
And not, again, as Jamie observed, not casting blame or aspersions, but simply identifying opportunities to really have that perfect conversation and perfect communication, so where the applicant knows exactly what it was they needed to provide us, and there was no these hundreds of back and forth between staff and this complete hemorrhaging of resource to resolve a what could have been a simple solution if you just had that great communication.
Okay. So just kind of as a follow-up to what Mike's talking about, Mitch, other than the 12, this 12-month example, 12-18, set that aside for a minute.
Sure.
What's the what's more typical? What's a more typical timeline that you're dealing with, the county deals with on a tax lot permit?
I'd have to say it's between 4 months and 14 months.
Okay.
It's a really wide window, and there's so many nuances based on the differentiation between the everything from the site grading to the stormwater to the wetlands and habitat. There's just, that's why we looked at that process, because it is so complex. The mechanics that we're going to get out of it are applicable to our permitting processes across the spectrum of everything we do, commercial, residential, industrial, and so forth.
I'm not discounting the process that you're going through.
Yeah. How were they 3-4 years ago? Do we have timelines from what they were in the, I guess,
comparable research?
Times. Yeah, comparable times. Is there something that happened that made them really bump up to these 4 to 14 months? I think I know part of the answer, but...
So talking, we have to look back at what happened during the recession, and when we had to lay off so much of our talent pool and our institutional knowledge was lost, where we had to utilize people wearing multiple hats, and we moved processes from one department to another, and I used development engineering as an example of that. You know, we had people in stormwater that were here, and now we moved them there to try and handle the volume of work that was necessary. And as a result of that, we lost a lot of capability and expertise along the way, and so the process began to kind of balloon, and one mistake or oversight or misinterpretation begat another and another and another, and the process became extended. And you know, along with the depletion of our resource and staffing and talent and knowledge, it was, you know, we're trying to rebuild that, but at the same time, we're not looking at replicating the past, we're looking at starting anew. And that's, we really have an opportunity here with CityGate and the recommendations to ask, how would we do it if we could build it brand new?
Getting to yes is great. That's really appreciated. I think that's really what this is about, is getting to yes. I think that's not always been maybe the experience of everybody that's going through the process.
Well, I can tell you with the relationships that have existed over the past few years and that generated the CityGate work and assessment, there were a lot of people feeling defensive and a lot of people feeling attacked on both sides of the equation, both our customers and us. And that's, getting this right really is going to alleviate a lot of those emotional pinch points along the way and work to build a stronger coalition of experts in the community that, I mean, seriously, at the end of the day, our customers out there that are dependent on all of us working together as experts to ensure that the structures they build are safe and occupiable and protect them as anticipated without any special knowledge or skill. They're all hoping that these buildings work right for them. We share this in common with them, and that we're all building owners and occupants. And we have expectations, whether we know about how a building functions or not, as to whether or not we can get out of the thing in the event of an alarm. And the people buying homes in our communities and occupying businesses, they come to us with that expectation, and we as stewards of the process have an obligation to work really well together and demonstrate how well we do work together.
So Rich, I suspect that the building itself is probably not the biggest issue. It's not much different when you look at the building code and all that, reviewing inside a subdivision versus outside. It's the site work.
Yes.
And it's the stormwater. And then I can tell you what's changed significantly is when clients of ours have had to go through just to build one house and a lot, you might as well be doing a subdivision now. I mean, you're looking at...
stormwater.
Yeah, the stormwater. And then what's trickled out is now you have engineers looking at that. And now they're looking at other pieces, too. So now all of a sudden we're regulating the roads in there, building the driveways almost like a private road. We're looking at site distance, intersection spacing, things that they kind of just used judgment before. I could say, they'd say, well, where's your best location? We can't deny access to the site. So where's the best place to put it? Put it here. That was a comment done. Now we're having to go through site distance analysis when the only outcome is, there's two outcomes. You can put it there, or it meets site distance, or we're going to let you put it somewhere else because we can't deny access, but we're going to have a lot of paperwork to get there. So that's those are the things that I can say have happened over the years. And then wetland, kind of the same thing, where we're doing like full probably wetland studies. And I don't know how, just to build a single family home, but you kind of have to make sure they're out of the critical areas, and GIS is not always that accurate.
Right.
So what did they do before that? I'm curious to see what that process was pre-recession. Not the recession. So what did we do well before and what's changed?
Well, one of the challenges at doing that kind of a look is pre-recession, the regulations were not as strict on these types of developments. I mean, 2006 is when critical areas started applying to single-family homes. And so we didn't really get a lot of experience with it before the recession. And then, you know, stormwater has built and come to what it is today in the last 2 or 3 years. And so I think, you know, part of the struggle has been wrapping our heads around how we deal with it, and you know, in trying to understand it before we can even find ways to try and make it the process as efficient as possible, understanding, you know, the scope of what we're trying to do on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you seeing that, Brent, because I think I was educated a lot. Like, I feel like I understood the county's black box process pretty well, but I think, you know, listening to the conversation that we had there, there was a lot of things that kind of illuminated for us. And I think a lot of the issues from our perspective can be headed off at the very beginning, but we need to understand how to reverse engineer, like where the stop points are there before we come up with a solution. I think with the critical areas and the stormwater stuff from the industry side, there's some, I think, some pretty easy solutions there that we want to offer up. Either do that today or wait for next week.
There's some low-hanging fruit right here that we've come after. So,
would you talk about, just to follow up to that, if I'm not, when you talk about low-hanging fruit, are you talking about extra requirements the county imposes over and above state and federal requirements?
No,
not at all.
Okay, then I'll just say that. Would you please also see what the extra requirements the county imposes over and above state and federal requirements and address those? That's the low-hanging fruit, as I see it.
Mm-hmm. It is. In this reverse engineering process, that'll all be on the table.
Yeah.
So it's all there for us to look at and evaluate.
Yeah, great.
So I can tell you that it will be considered.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I guess moving along with that, an example of an idea that we're looking at to help improve the experience in particular with stormwater is that we're looking at reorganizing the review and inspection process for the site work related to these building permits. So instead of having the permit center do reviews on one minimum requirement 1 through 5 and having to go to development engineering to do a 1 through 9, and then if you got a critical areas permit, you're working with my folks, and those groups are all trying to coordinate with each other behind the scenes. What we would like to do is to bring that all under one program so that, you know, we have a better opportunity to integrate those processes with the building permit review process that the permit center does. And in addition to that, following through during construction with the inspection requirements, making sure that the people who are doing those inspections are in the same house with the people who have done the reviews so that there can be coordination. And we see a lot of opportunities. You know, and a particular example is that a lot of times we get out in the field and these stormwater plans for the 1 through 9s, there's site issues because they weren't designed with a topographic survey. And changes need to be made in the field to make it work. And right now, that change process has to go back through a full post-plan review in order to be fixed. And what I would like to see is an opportunity where we have the expertise directly accessible to the inspectors to essentially make a fix in the field and document it through an as-built, as opposed to actually having to go all the way back through the loop. Now, certainly there will be cases where the change is significant enough that it does have to go through a more formal review. But what the folks that are doing these inspections now have seen is a lot of cases where the change is relatively simple, but it has to go back through a review process with an engineer in order to be approved. So that's just an example. So in addition to bringing the stormwater piece in the house, we're also talking about pulling in some of the other site-related things, like the floodplain reviews and the relatively minor things that seem to be working well, but seems like it's an appropriate fit. In addition to that, we would be doing all the inspection work or verification work that planning staff are currently doing on things like landscaping. I think this might give us an opportunity to look at how we can take some of those plat requirements and maybe defer them in some cases to the building phase when it makes sense, because we'll actually have inspection staff that's what they do, and they're already out going to these sites anyway, so we aren't having to generate a whole nother level of inspection and review to verify that the fences or the landscaping are getting put in with each home that's being built. So in terms of staffing, the program we would be bringing the biologists that are doing the wetland and habitat reviews into the program, and then we would be looking to have a professional engineer as the lead reviewer for the engineering related work, and supported by a technical staff position and a permit technician position. On the inspection side, we would be looking for two inspectors that would strictly be focused on site work, and then having an office assistant to support the administrative functions and that sort of thing.
Brett, quick question. Is this only for the tax lots that we were referring to talking about previously, or for all single-family residential lots?
So,
because I would think in a subdivision, you wouldn't have to...
Right. Well, there is some work that would occur in subdivisions, but it wouldn't be. I guess I'll back up a little bit. So I think the way this would be operating is the routine erosion control inspections would continue to be done by the building inspectors. But today, when they come to the site and the erosion control log is not available, or there's some significant issue that they see, they don't perform the rest of the inspections. They leave the site, and it's an incomplete inspection. And so all those other inspections that could have been done don't get done.
Okay.
And so what we're talking about is they would continue to do that erosion control inspection, but if that's not ready, instead of walking away, they would complete their other inspections, and they would flag that job for us to follow up and get the erosion control in order. So we would be doing that in subdivisions. In addition to that, there's more general site-related work, things that go on, not specifically on each lot, but for instance, concrete washouts, that sort of thing. So we would be looking, retaining walls is another example. We would be keeping our eye on those things and being the point in getting those issues resolved. So that the buildings themselves can continue to move forward. In terms of the staffing and the titles and what we call these people, we're still working on our HR folks with that. But we want to have a PE that's basically leading the charge, so that we have somebody even for the 1 through 5 reviews that we can go to for those more technical questions that come up, and that basically every approval is backed by their stamp.
So on that, do you guys have the resources to put a PE on these SFRs? Because what I'm seeing is it might be, I mean, there's probably a shortage already in among staff to be able to
right.
review all the subdivision site plans, larger projects.
We would be looking to hire another engineer to do
yeah.
this.
And it really does. You have to have the right kind of engineer, too. I mean, mm-hmm. they're not all created equal, for sure. And you get some engineers by nature. I am one. We tend to complicate things. yeah, right? I mean, you have to
right
get through it.
There is an answer right there.
Yeah.
A lawyer. So maybe that's like...
I obfuscate.
I mean, we... I mean...
Are you suggesting an attorney?
No, right. But, I mean, engineers can dive too deep into it. I think one of the problems we had is that we used to, you know, when it started doing stormwater, we're looking at a lot of things, we're diving into a lot of details that really are insignificant. So you get the wrong person on it, they're going to think something's very important that really is pretty trivial out in the field. Well, like that example you had about moving a, you know, having to go back through review if you have to move the trench a little bit, well, most SFRs, they don't have full surveys. So, and then we don't even know what the grading is going to be after the contractor's out there, because they don't even know what it's going to be. So they change the grade of the site a little bit, something doesn't work. It's a pretty simple fix if you use some common sense on where to put it. It probably doesn't have to go back through plan review.
Yeah, so
or post-plan change.
We're really going to focus on having the right person making the right decision at the right time and resourcing and empowering those individuals to make those decisions. And if we have to advertise for an uncomplicated engineer...
right? I mean, you got to hire right. We try to hire yeah, right well, in-house, and too.
I think one of whatever the advantages...
It's hard right now.
It is.
You got to get the right people.
They're brought into a team, I think, is where Brent's going with that. You know, so they're right there in-house with that inspector, with the environmental person, you know, they're kind of working at it as a team. Right now, largely speaking, those due to work volume, those reviews are going out to independent consultants. So, and kind of do a good job, of course, but just structurally, you know, it creates some disadvantages when that resource is not incorporated in a team environment with those other direct key people, you know, that are critical to that project going forward. So,
is there enough volume to support this?
There's
oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know. So, thank you.
yeah.
So, and I appreciate what you guys are coming. I think this is great.
Yeah.
And this is obviously, I kind of view this as once the thing is submitted, this is your internal system. I think from the private side issue, one of the things that we're hearing from a lot of our members is when they're paying, you know, good consultants, good money, put professionals, engineering stamps on it. It's ones you guys have experience with. And I know Deep has talked about this for many years.
Ad nauseum.
You know, if there is a PE stamp on it, or if we have a wetlands biologist with, you know, certain credibility, you know, Francis, Kevin, whoever, that writes up their report, shouldn't those get a little bit maybe less scrutiny from the county reviewers as a means of sort of speeding up the process, because they're the ones putting their license on the line?
I would say, you know, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things from my experience is that we don't, at least on the wetland and habitat side, we haven't always gotten the same quality of work in those cases. And my presumption is that, you know, the clients are in sticker shock. you know, and when I was a consultant, I actually wouldn't work for homeowners because I had too many cases where I couldn't even get paid. Once they got the answer and they didn't like it, they're like, I'm not going to pay the bill. and so, you know, I think that's a challenge on your side is being able to throw the same resources on your side at these projects because, you know, we still need the same quality of work
right.
to be able to get through the process efficiently.
And that is a problem because if it's being regulated like a subdivision, you get a wetland study for a subdivision,
yeah.
depending on the size, it's probably, you know, maybe $6,000. On a single family home, you've got an $800 budget. Because it starts adding really quickly to a cost on a very small project with one home in it, and that study now is only spread over that one home, so it's significant. Same thing with stormwater. We're trying to do these stormwater plans, there might as well be just like a subdivision. But the budget for those, again, is, you know, maybe 1,500 to 2,000, or maybe more depending on the situation. But it's a single family home. And on a subdivision, you're spending a lot more time going through a lot more reviews. That's probably, again, like maybe a $5,000 item. You have to do it in less time because it's spread out over one home. And the at the end of the day, it's not as significant. The risk is lower because you only have one home. Before, we didn't have to do any of this stuff. And we didn't have a lot of issues. The water had plenty of places to disperse. So we're doing very fancy, detailed studies, going through a lot of calculations to show we're doing splash blocks. And we're going through three reviews to do it. And we know exactly where we're going to end at the end. And then we get a new reviewer, and what we go through is multiple reviews. We know we're going to end up the same place at the end of the day. We always do. But it's how much we have to educate the new reviewer that's hired, or that's an outside consultant, because they can't make a judgment call. And the regulations that the state handed down really don't work with SFRs. So we have to educate them every time how to basically fake the model to do dispersion, because there's no way in the model that works. It's not set up for dispersion. So there's no way to do it. So we've created kind of a way to do it, and most of the engineers know how to do it in town now, but it's not by the book, because there's no way to do it by the book. You're kind of making a judgment call. So, and those are the things that go back, and we go through three reviews because of that same issue every time.
So what are you suggesting as a solution?
Well, I think if you've gone through the process enough, that for the stormwater plans, you get certified as a consultant. And they don't need a review. Maybe, and they're also the ones that are responsible to make a judgment call if something doesn't work in the field. So take it off your plate. You guys don't need an inspector to do that. If there's a conflict out in the field, send it back, and we'll make a new recommendation. We'll go out there, look at it, and say, move it here instead, because that was the intent. And then you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, field solutions are always a great option when you've granted confidence in the engineering record. They've submitted the stormwater. They've submitted all the wetland stuff. You've accepted it with a minimal review, but when you do have an inspector on the site, you notice during a particular rain event or whatever, that there's failure of the systems as planned. They're not functioning as designed. Because of the life of permit and permitted work on any construction site, we have ample opportunity to do those field reviews, draw their attention to it. Now we have a consolidated work unit that can address that stuff head on, has the highest probability they're going to communicate exactly the information that's necessary to remedy the situation, and can do that outside the construction process, as long as it's not washing the structure or foundation system away in the same breath.
Yeah, I mean,
not to get too into the weeds here, this isn't the committee meeting, that was just an example. So we have plenty of time to talk about it in the meetings upcoming, but that's just some of the low-hanging fruit, I think.
Thanks for joining us there, by the way.
So to get to Mike's question about the workload, the way that we're looking at funding this is basically using the existing fee structure for all of this work and moving it into this program. And when I budgeted it out, there's still particularly on the erosion control inspection side, there's still some surplus that would support the work that the building inspectors are going to be doing routinely. So at least initially, we don't anticipate any changes to the fees that are currently being collected for this work. Once we get it under our belts and learn about it and figure out how to improve it, we may be coming back in the future, 2020, to make some adjustments on how we fund this.
What's the hope on, what is your plan on implementation? What is that?
We're trying to align it with phase three of LMS. We're actually already incorporating the changes we need in LMS for this program. We got into it early enough that we could get it into phase three. But to try and do it prior to that, we would have to figure out how to essentially use the processes that development engineering has in place for their plan review, which would require some software licensing that we would only need for a few months. And so it just makes more sense to try and get it aligned. It also fits well with the budget and the changes that need to be made in the budget. So we'll be talking about, I guess at this point it's early February, You know, in the meantime, we want to get all the approvals we need internally so that we can start hiring people, start getting people trained. We also want to do our best to take advantage of the expertise we already have. So, you know, the hope is that the individuals that are currently doing this work will, you know, move into this program as opposed to us having to bring all new people in and figure it out from scratch. So, any other questions?
So you guys are getting support from the board then on this, on these positions. It sounds like that's a given here. We talked about the staffing up during the recession for a long time, and that's now we're here. So I'm hoping you guys are getting support.
Well, we have vacant positions in community development that were actually, a couple of them at least, were actually created to do some of this work, and they haven't been filled yet. We can't, you know, we have to look at appropriate classifications and that sort of thing. But, you know, we haven't really figured out that piece of the puzzle of how the positions move around or get created. But, you know, that's really the bulk of what we need to work on to make this happen internally.
Yep. And I can tell you that the board has expressed a lot of support for the work that we're doing on the functional oversight team and with the CityGate implementation, which is, this all kind of works into. So if we have commitment from them to continue to support this type of work and effort. What we need today is your support. So if a resolution or motion would be entertained, that would be great. Yeah.
So move.
What's your motion?
To support Brent's efforts there to reposition the staff in.
Consolidation of services.
Building permit process services. In community.
Mitch, what wording, thank you, and I forgive me for asking Mitch now what wording he might suggest.
Yeah, just the way that the title of the article here is consolidation of services related to site development for the building permit process. So your support for that movement in that direction would be great.
Thank you, Jamie.
Did you say that?
There's the motion.
That's what he said. Now.
Okay, did I second it? I thought
he's got it.
Well, as far as discussion, just thank you guys for your work on this.
I'll second.
Cut you off.
No,
there was no second. Oh, okay. Discussion. The only discussion
I was just gonna say very
is, again, is I appreciate that staff is coming up with solutions for the review part of the process. Again, hopefully we can address the front end also and try to get better product in with you guys. And that's, I think, part of my main focus in the discussion.
So one of the unmentioned things here today is our ongoing requirement for compliance with NPDES. And when we have this consolidation will help us build a very robust nexus and communication point for that compliance work that ensures that everything is accountable, everything is auditable in that case, and responsive as quickly as possible. And educating our experts in the field in that same response is critical to the success of the program. So, yeah, early and often communication and high quality communication is kind of a linchpin for all this. Well, thank you all.
All the value.
All the value.
Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Nice job.
All right.
There you go.
Thank you, Brent.
Yes. Any public comment?
I just like
Ryan find a
match. Maybe, yeah. I don't know.
Yes. We've done official.
Oh, I didn't know where the production. Okay, whatever. I missed
three meetings.
No. 2 meetings ago, I missed, so I didn't know whether. I think Mitch was right around there.
Yeah, I'm kind of new to
the game. Yeah, so 2 meetings ago, I missed. I might not have met you, but I'm going to be calling you on final plat, which is something this group has been working on, and kind of like to do the same thing. It's something that's been going on for years, and it's gone back now where I'm personally experiencing and hearing from other people, you know, 5-6 reviews, and I've got very good consultants I'm getting things back with typos and things like that. It just drives you crazy.
So a lot of that.
I don't know if anyone else is experiencing that, but I heard
I'm
from.
I'm holding up on that. I'm the site plan.
So I will tell you that the entire development review process is subject to continuous improvement.
Right, and that's
as a result of that.
We had a subcommittee that had a whole list of recommendations. I think it's all been kind of forgotten. So, I don't know. How are you guys experiencing them?
One of the recommendations I would make is the management will encourage solutions for different things. And it doesn't get translated down to line staff. And for example, we are voracious about taking advantage of the lean process. When we have something pulled out of the lean process, I can just tell you with the amount of time I spend on those issues, you just add $1,000 to press that out just by pulling it out of the lean process for what can be, and what in our experience has been, misinterpretations by staff, not mistakes we have made, and we can identify and improve that. And so one of the encouragements that I would make would be whatever decisions get made at the managerial level, policy decisions, investing decisions, legal decisions, there's got to be a way to get that translated down to line staff. Or alternatively, if you're going to pull something from a leading process, pull something from a process for a reason, it should be done with some consultation first. And whether through the applicant or through management, because I hate having to go over guys' heads. It's insulting, it's not what I like to do either, but that's the way the game's been played so far. It's frustrating.
I totally appreciate your position. I think that's shared by a huge number of our customers. So the way we manage that internally with this new process is by doing very robust standard operating procedures and making sure that everybody's working on the same decision-making matrix. So if you're a new employee and you're here and you find yourself in front of a customer with an application for lean, you can do an equally proficient review of that application as anybody with 3 years experience could. The reliance is on management to become excellent communicators internally as well as with our external partners, and that is definitely on the table. That work is underway right now.
Well, I'm excited to have you aboard.
Yep, it really is. Yep.
It is truly a pleasure.
Okay. I've got a very quick one. Right now for August, we have a completely open agenda. So not that I need to have agenda items like immediately, but if you want to, something's on your mind, you want to make sure we get it on the August agenda. And I'll send out an email prompting this. But anything come to mind?
I hate to be a broken record, but I would like us to continue to pursue this. Code amendment about certification of consultants.
For SFRs?
For SFRs.
Yeah,
and not just engineers. We can talk about how many pathologists
take. It kind of wraps in that other process, but.
Greg, is there a separate, are we going to continue the discussion on remarks?
I know that, Lori, who's just here with us, she just wrote me a note today. She just kind of sent it actually out to Dean members. Her and Bill are coming in at least in September. To review theirs and park boundary adjustments. Mike just left us. So I don't know if he had anything in mind. I know that the Parks Advisory Board reached out to Deeb and invited Deeb members to come in to their next PAB meeting.
Talking specifically about inventory issues, what constitutes a park, what's in the inventory, what should be, what's not there, that kind of stuff. I thought we had a commitment to pursue that at one point. Somebody's kind of falling.
That was last month, if I remember right, and so I think there was going to be follow up with that. Maybe we can.
I'll get with Mike and see if he's.
So
got anything further.
Just for
I think the park commissioners too internally need to have that conversation discussion to be able to, so there was needing the time for that to take place.
I just I, you know, I thought this put together a fairly extensive piece of documentation after
you were going to say something?
No, you did it.
This, out of curiosity, the implementing CityGate, or the functional oversight team, how does that fit in with, I always forget their name, I call them Black Ops, Black Ops Team 1 and Team 2. It, you know what I'm talking about? The
project delivery.
The micro.
Project delivery. Thank you. It does not stick in my brain. Is that a different? I mean, it seems like there's overlap between these two, maybe, or not, or is
no,
there?
No.
Are there? Is there no overlap between?
This is elite? Just looking at one specific process, which is SFRs on rural lots or on tax lots.
Oh, this functional oversight.
The committee is looking at one process.
The functional oversight is just looking at one process.
It's the SFRs, right now.
We're taking one as an example to get an idea of where process problems are. As a case study.
Right.
The intent is, according to Mitch, this group is going to, after this process of these issues are highlighted, their group's going to pare down but continue on and look at other processes.
Okay.
And try to use this as a first. This is basically, we're putting a case study in front of us to get an idea of what, to figure out what we don't know already before we start chasing ghosts. Is what, that's the feeling I got from our first meeting. But.
Yeah, and it's stuff that specifically identified in the CityGate.
Perfect. So the other one's still.
Yeah.
Well, you keep rolling your eyes.
Well, yeah. The big picture group hasn't met it.
That's why I was going to ask, because you were looking for agenda items. I was actually going somewhere with that. We usually got a report on that every once in a while, and I kind of got dark. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. All clear now.
If you're looking for additions, maybe the Chawachi Burian Rails would be in with Busy Alvarez.
Okay.
That industrial, what is that? What is it? You know, it's taking some light. Yeah.
We're just about done.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
And what does the county hope to connect that to? Ultimately, it's a small segment, but. In the long term,
once
it's connected to the main line.
I actually
probably noticed the move.
Could I suggest you reach out to Susan Ellinger and ask her about the details? I think the details committee was just about finished. Did I?
No. Yeah,
maybe I'm behind
what you're saying. And kind of get the
I think it's almost ready to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Is
that the?
The details.
Committee.
There's a big picture and a small picture.
Oh, thanks. Black Ops 1 is the details. Committee, that's right. I remember that. And then the big picture.
All right, we're in good shape.
We're good?
Yep.